Okay, now we're going to do talk number two in the discipleship series that we've started. And let me begin by saying this. So in this series of talks, one of my overall objectives is to try to give a more realistic picture of the hardships and conflicts and troubles and struggles and problems that we need to expect to experience if we become a Christian. As opposed to being simply a nominal churchgoer who's a notional Christian. Because you can be a notional churchgoer and you won't get any trouble at all. You'll have no struggles, no problems, no ethical problems, no persecution, no conflict. Well, you just have no problems. You're just part of a social club. There won't be any problems. But if you want to be a real Christian, a real disciple, you need to count the cost of what's going to be involved in it. You need to realise what it's going to be like. And I spoke last time about Jesus. If he was selling a car, he tells you the downside of that car first. And if you're still interested, he tells you some of the good things about the car. But he tells you the downside first. And that's what we need to do if we're contemplating being a Christian. And if we didn't do it at the time, we need to do it now. And talk about now what is involved in being a disciple, because many of us are Christians but we're not really disciples, or if we are, we're very weak and flimsy ones. And we can say, equally we can say, I'm a weak and flimsy disciple, but I want to be a real one, and I want to count the cost in the way that Jesus told us we should. So we need to count that cost, count it properly, ideally before we're even converted. But if not, if that wasn't what we did, if we didn't manage that, do it now. Count the cost now. Going forward, what's the cost? Because that's the way. If we are aware of these things, have taken them to account, have accepted them, have reconciled ourselves to them, we'll be so much better placed to handle the struggles and problems and persecution and conflict and difficulty and cost that's going to come. And we won't be surprised or resentful when it arises. You see? So, the thought came to me, just that it reminded me as I was just preparing this, in the context of some of us being unaware of the reality of what's coming. When I was 12, there was a school trip to go sea fishing on the North Sea. And that was in November. And so I got up. We had to set off at 4:30 in the morning. So my dad, he came, got up with me to go, and came with me to the school because we were going in the middle of the night. He walked up to the school with me. But when I got up in the morning, my dad looked at me. I'd got dressed, and he looked at the way I was dressed, and he said, "What are you doing? Is that what you're expecting to go to the North Sea on in dressed like that?" Sure. And I'd not quite shorts and slippers, no, but I'd got on like a jumper and a light jacket. And he said, "You can't go to the North Sea like that. Do you realise what it's going to be like on the North Sea today?" And I didn't. I thought he was making a fuss about nothing. So anyway, he made me get dressed again, go and put about two vests and a jumper and a jacket and then a coat on top of that. And I thought it was way over the top. Way over the top. Because being a 12-year-old, of course, I knew everything about it. I didn't know quite as much as a teenager knows, because that's 100% knowledge. But the thing is, my dad thought he knew a bit about it. Anyway, we got to the North Sea and it was absolutely bitter. It was the wind chill factor, the spray in the air. It was freezing point that day, but it was way below freezing point because of the chill factor and the spray. And then I realised what he'd been going on about, why he'd made a fuss about it, why he was projecting forwards as to what's coming. And to me, that was an apt metaphor for how many of us enter into the Christian life with a light jacket on, thinking, "This will be plenty. I'm fine. It's going to be okay." Our expectations are utterly unrealistic. So that's what we should do. We should realize it's going to be like the North Sea out there. What lies ahead? There are going to be times, at least, when it's going to be like that. So having said that, in the context of this thing of affliction or persecution, the truth of it is this: many of us are not actually sufficiently recognisable as Christians in the first place to be seen as a threat by any of God's enemies, whether human enemies or demonic enemies. And so many notional churchgoers don't receive any persecution anyway, because they're just not a threat. But if you are real, and you determine to be real, then you are a threat, and if you are a threat, you'll be treated as a threat. So the logic here is a little circular. You're not going to be persecuted unless you're a threat. If you want to be a real Christian, you'll be a threat, then you'll be persecuted. If you're happy to be notional, nominal, just a cultural Christian, you'll be all right. You won't get persecution. So, why then do so few people count the cost, look ahead to the problems, anticipate conflict or persecution? Why do they not anticipate these things? One of the main reasons is that it's not preached on, as with so many other topics. It's not preached on. So difficulty, cost, persecution, affliction, struggle, conflict, alienation, unpopularity, all these things are not preached on. Why? Because leaders rationally and correctly take the view that if they told you the truth about these things, then you would probably leave their churches. Who's going to go to a church where people going about the North Sea and having to wear loads of coats and how difficult it's going to be and how much struggle there's going to be? Who wants to be in a church like that, when you can be in a church that talks about how easy everything is and how it's going to be nice? And so many leaders take the view that it's much better to give a comfortable, comforting message and just be popular and accepted by people and have people come to that church and don't put people off by talking about, like Jesus would sell a car, by talking about its low fuel performance and its and different aspects of it's not very good in town and these things that Jesus would say if he was selling a car. They don't want to do that. They want to talk about how easy it's all going to be and how nice it all is. So such men really are hirelings. What's a hireling? It's a man just doing a paid job. It's not his vocation or his ministry or his conviction or his heart's passion. It's none of those things. He's just a man doing a paid job. And he's no more committed to the gospel than some other man is to making widgets in a factory. It's just a job. Just a job to him. And so such people, such leaders, will say what people want to hear rather than what they need to hear. I didn't want my dad going on about wearing two coats and two vests and all this kind of nonsense. I didn't want to hear that. He was making a fuss about nothing. But he insisted on making a fuss about nothing. And later I was glad he did. But at the time I wasn't entirely in agreement with him that morning. So, let's look at some of the things that are involved. Let's look at some of this bad news and what's involved. I'll try and go through a few of these things. Let's look firstly at this, the concept of deep commitment. Being a disciple involves deep commitment to Jesus Christ and a determination to follow and obey him for the rest of your life. Now that ought to be a complete statement of the absolutely obvious, but it is not a statement of the absolutely obvious, because most people don't know that. Most people don't think that's got anything to do with it. Well, to begin with, the word disciple itself is rarely even used in most Western churches today, let alone taught on. So what do we have in the United Kingdom? We have churchgoers. So when we're spoken about on the news, when they say such and such a thing happened and the churchgoers are alarmed about this, that's what they say, churchgoers. Now, that's what they think we are, churchgoers. But the word churchgoer, it's a loaded phrase. It means, in 99% of the time, notional, cultural, nominal, lukewarm, flimsy. It doesn't mean any of these things: deep commitment to Jesus Christ, determination to follow him, determination to obey him. It doesn't mean disciple. It doesn't mean radical. It doesn't mean passionate. It doesn't mean committed. It doesn't mean any of those things. And so therefore, most churchgoers, in inverted commas, in the United Kingdom, have little or no idea about how radical the Bible is about the expectations that Jesus has of us. Just have no idea. Have never heard about it. When you become his disciple, and becoming his disciple is something that you can do after you've been converted, and for many, many, many of us, that's what actually happens. We are converted and we just become a convert, and might be a convert for 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 15 years. And then you wake up and you realize you're just a convert. You're not a disciple. You're not really following him. Well, if that's your position, then wake up. Wake up now. Don't just mourn the fact you've wasted 5 or 10 years. Wake up now and become his disciple. Even if you are just a flimsy sort of lukewarm churchgoer, repent of it now. Change now. Become a disciple now. But if you do, then it means that commitment to follow, obey, and devote your entire life to him. You're meant to hand over everything you have, all that you have, to him. All that you have and all that you are, to him. And that includes your possessions, your career plans, your ambitions, your relationships, including romantic relationships, including who you marry and everything. Whether you marry includes handing over your own body to him. Everything about you, everything, is to be handed over to him. Now, this is bordering on being just a teensy bit radical, isn't it, saying things like that? Who wants to buy a car when it's presented in those terms? But that is the real, authentic message of the Bible about what being a disciple is. That's what it means. So Jesus doesn't say join the army, see the world, build a good career. You know, like the army recruitment stuff. That's not how. If Jesus was running an army recruitment centre, he wouldn't have pictures up with smiling soldiers, all, you know, enjoying life in the barracks, or life, you know, or some sailor on the ocean wave enjoying life. That's not the pictures he'd have up. He would say, join the army, get killed, get shot, get wounded, suffer, run on Dartmoor, get cold, get exhausted. This is how his army recruitment service office would be presenting itself. I remember when I became a Christian, I was well ministered to by this chap called Dave Brown, who was very good actually. And I had Bible studies with him from October to June of that year. And he went through all sorts of stuff. And he presented a radical gospel message. But also I was reading the Bible myself, and I was actually looking at some of the things Jesus said, asking Dave Brown, what's that? What's this about? What does this mean? What does he want us to give up? And in a sense, I was making the message even more radical than he was making it. But I concluded, before I became a Christian, even before conversion, which is most unusual, but I concluded that Jesus wanted me to give up everything to him. And at that time, I was planning to go into law and also business, and also politics. Those are the three things I wanted to do. I wanted to be a lawyer, I wanted to run a business, and I wanted to be involved in politics. And I concluded that I had to give up everything to be his disciple. And that's one of the reasons why I held off for a while. Because I thought, well, this is a big thing to do. Because I could have just raised my hand. I see that hand. I could have raised a hand back in the October and been a convert. But something told me not to do that. Partly Dave Brown, partly me, partly the Holy Spirit saying, don't do that. Do this properly. And I reached a point where I concluded this is inescapable. If I'm to be his disciple, I must hand over everything. Totally change my expectations for life. And I concluded that God would probably want me to go as a missionary. And I just imagined Africa would be the place. Obviously, that's where you go if you're a missionary. So I had just, I totally abandoned all thoughts of law and business and politics. I'll obviously end up going to Africa as a missionary, that's what it'll have to be. And I accepted that and said, okay, I accept those terms. I accept your terms and conditions. I will become your disciple. And I think Jesus was pleased with that. Actually, he had no intentions whatsoever of me going to Africa. The African people have been spared that. And now, he never sent me there. But I thought that's where I was going. I thought it, and made that deal with him. And you know, the funny thing is, that in the years after that, he gave me all three of those things back again. And I ended up going into law, and business, and running my own businesses, and even going into politics. For years, I did all those three things that I gave up. But I gave them to him, he put them in his back pocket, and then several years later, Jesus got them out of his back pocket and gave them back to me. But the point was, it was him giving them to me, and I had totally given them up. He had pity on Africa, he didn't send me there, and he gave me these three things back again. But the operative point is, I was willing, and that's what touched him. That's what touched him. He thought, you're willing to give all that to me? Right. I'll hold on to it for a bit and I'll give it back to you. But I'm really touched that you gave it to me. He might not have given it back to me. As it happened, he did. The operative point is, give everything to him. You cannot lose. If you give everything to him, you just cannot lose. It's the right thing to do. But it's not what the churches are preaching. Because it's assumed that doing that is just far too much over the top. It's far too radical. No one's going to want that kind of a message. Who's going to go to a church that says things like that? Giving figures would plummet if we lose 90% of our members. And we just can't possibly preach a message like that. So most preachers don't preach it, and most Christians don't want it, or it doesn't occur to them. When they read the Bible, they don't see any of this radical stuff in the Bible. It's edited out, they just don't see it. And most of us in the West, I'm only really qualified to talk about the West, most of us here in the West settle for a life which is far less challenging, productive and adventurous than God wants us to have. And what he actually wants is to aim very high, or to aim high and seek to become the best, most committed disciple that we can possibly be, and to achieve great things with him and for him relative to the level of talent that we've been given. That's what we should be doing. That's what our ambition should be. Now, a Christian is meant to be ambitious. He should be ambitious to be the best disciple that he can be. That's not a wrong thing, that's a right thing. So ambition is perfectly right. It's just ambitious about what is the issue. So instead of that level of commitment that we ought to have, preferably right at the outset, most of us instead want an easy life. We want just comfort. We want to avoid inconvenience, avoid hard work, avoid problems, avoid discomfort, avoid having to sleep out overnight on Dartmoor. We don't want that. We just want comfortable living, no problems. But because we want that, many of us are missing out on real blessings that God can give us that can come and will come through being a disciple. So at the same time, what I'm doing here, at the same time as recognizing the difficulties and the costs, it's also valid to recognize the advantages and the benefits, most of which are long term. But they're nonetheless real. Okay, so although becoming a disciple is a radical and costly step, it's also true to say that it does bring enormous blessings and advantages, not only in the future but here and now, but especially in the future. At the judgment seat, one thing is for sure. Probably there won't be a single person at the judgment seat who wishes they had been less committed, wishes they'd been less radical. I doubt if even Apostle Paul will think that. Every one of us who gets there will think, I wish I had taken my chance to be more committed, more radical, more decisive, more willing to pay the price. I really don't think a single person will say, do you know something, in retrospect, I think I was a bit over the top. I should have been a little more flexible and a bit more lukewarm. It would have been better overall. I don't think there'll be a single person saying that. Now, if you can hear those words now and agree with them, and I doubt if you could disagree with them, then why not implement them? Why not say, yeah, that's correct. That will be the case at the judgment, so why don't I act upon that now? And in every opportunity I have to make a decision at a small level about the price I'm willing to pay, let me up the price I'm willing to pay. Do that now, each day. So, okay. So being a Christian, now, being a real disciple, involves handing over your whole life to Jesus Christ, the whole lock, stock and barrel, a complete surrender of your own will, everything, possessions, even your own life, even whether you live or die. That's how radical it needs to be. And this is not an entirely theoretical thing. It's soon to be, even here in the lukewarm West, soon people will be having to give their lives up for the gospel. Not that far away. And so that is the right way to think of it. And I'm reminded of a scene from a film, a series I like called The Band of Brothers, about the 106th Airborne Division. And in that, there's a particular officer called Captain Spears, Ronald Spears. And he's talking to a private. And this private is scared after they've invaded Normandy. And Captain Spears, who's a lieutenant at that point, but Spears says to him, to this soldier, the advice he gives him I thought was very inspired. And he says to him, the thing to do in order to function as a soldier, you've got to accept that you're not going home. You've got to accept that you're going to die in Normandy. You're going to die here. You're not going home. You're not going to survive. Accept it now. And if you can accept that, you'll begin to function. Because otherwise, if you're harbouring hopes of surviving D-Day and surviving D-Day plus one, and I hope I can survive D-Day plus two, and you're trying to survive, you can't function in the way you're meant to. And so Spears said, that's the thing. Accept death. Accept it. You're not going home. And you never know, you might go home. But the point is, accept it and you'll be able to function properly in the job you're meant to do. Well, that little suggestion that he made to that man that day is very right in relation to the Christian life. If you accept everything, say, right, I'm going to accept the lot. Everything, every attack upon my career, my finances, my popularity, my reputation, even my life, I'm willing to be martyred. I'm signing on the dotted line, Jesus, I accept everything, anything, whatever. Total, complete loss of life, absolute loss of everything. Marriage, I'll never be married. That was another thing I thought I'll have to give up. Who's going to want to come to Africa with me? I'm going to have to give up marriage. That's going to have to go, but it'll have to go. There it is. Well, I gave up everything. And that's the way to do it. Give up the lot. Make that deal now, and the whole thing will function. You'll be able to function as a disciple. Because if you've said, well, I've totally handed over my career, then when someone brings in a regulation saying that you must be willing to sign certificates to marry gay men, you can say no. Yeah, well, you'll lose your career if you do that. Well, you say, well, that's no problem, because I've already signed a contract with Jesus whereby I've just abandoned all career hopes. And therefore, no problem, because I've already agreed to lose the career. That's no problem. If they take my career off me, well, what's the problem? I've already lost it. In my mind, I've already lost it. Oh, well, we'll take your life from you. It doesn't matter, because in my mind, I've already lost my life. Like Captain Spears, in my mind, I'm not coming home from Normandy. It's a one-way ticket to Normandy for me. I'm not coming home. So if they want to take my life, it's no problem. I've already agreed to that. Do you see? If you will do that, you rob the enemy of all their hold over you. Because they use your money, your career, your marriage prospects, your popularity, you name it, everything, your home, your pension, you name it, your life, as a hold over you. And they can use those things to gain leverage over you, to get you to compromise. But if you say, no, no, I've abandoned all those things, those things have no leverage over me. And there's that poor little demon there pushing on these levers, and there's no traction, it's not working. He's just pushing on levers, he's pressing buttons that aren't connected to anything. Someone's cut the wires. He's pushing on levers that someone's cut the connections, and that's not working. And this is the thing, if that's why it's so important to make that decision at the outset, to count the cost, agree the contract, you say, yes, Jesus, I hand over to you everything. Absolutely everything. And you're free. And I know this is true because I did it. I know it's true. And it gives you a confidence that you would not otherwise have. So, therefore, a real Christian, a real disciple, must be willing to receive the whole package of whatever it means, whatever it takes, both good and bad. And those words jar with modern ears. It sounds excessive. Because we live in an age which has largely forgotten what discipleship is. Even in the church, I've just no idea what it means. And we don't like to talk about duty, self-sacrifice, hardship. You see, the men of World War II, and the men of World War I even more so, to them, words like duty, self-sacrifice, patriotism, loyalty, comradeship, all these words meant something. Those words mean almost nothing to our generation. They're simply meaningless words. They've been lost to the language. They weren't lost to those people's language. They understood those words. But our generation doesn't. And what we need to do is retrieve those words. Even though it puts us in a small minority, retrieve those words and act upon them, live by them. So, we accept the whole package, but let me add this. Nevertheless, that it is valid to say and pray this, which I have done. And that is to say, I'm willing to take anything, but I think it's quite reasonable to sort of ask Jesus, to sort of negotiate with him, to talk with him in this way. And say, I will take anything, but can we agree on this? This is what I've asked him to do. That you won't test me beyond my limits, and oblique or, if you do, that you'll supply me with the grace to go beyond my limits. So don't ask me to run a 4-minute mile, because I can't do it. But if you want me to, enable me to run one. Do you see? Either don't ask me to run a 4-minute mile, or turn me into Rogers Bannister so I can do it. Do you see the point? So I'd say to him, don't ask me to, don't put me in a test that I'll fail, that you know I'll fail. Don't let me sit any exam that's too hard for me. So wouldn't you say that to your piano teacher? Don't put me in for a grade until you think I can do it. Do you see? And that's what I've said to Jesus. Don't put me in for a piano grade until you think I'll pass it. But if you want me to do something really hard, will you supernaturally give me the grace to jump me up by 3 piano grades to be able to take it? Do you see? Do you see that point? Now that's a valid and sensible prayer. I think Jesus responds to sensible prayers like that. Mm-hmm. And so rather than being full of bravado, oh yes, bring it on, I can take anybody on. That's not Christian, that's not discipleship, that's being silly. What we mean, what we should be doing is saying, look, Jesus, I'm willing to hand everything over to you, but you must realise, Jesus, I'm scared even while I'm saying it. And so what I want you to do, don't push me beyond my limits, but if you must and you need to, then increase my limits. I don't want to fail any exams. I want to pass every exam I take. Do you see what I'm saying? So, Jesus Christ is not looking for fans and admirers. He's not trying to get his likes up on Facebook or get more retweets. He's not looking for that. What he's after is not fans. He's looking for complete, absolute loyalty and devoted service. You need to think of him perhaps more in terms of, say, a medieval king. We've lost the ability to think in these terms because we live in democratic times where we don't think in terms of loyalty to a king. But imagine you were living at the time of Henry II or someone like that. These words would mean something to you. Today we don't really know what it even means to have loyalty to a sovereign. It just doesn't mean much to us. We might stand at the roadside waving a little Union Jack. That's what we mean by loyalty. We like it when the Queen comes by, we can wave, and she'll wave at us, and that's nice. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about being willing to die on behalf of this King Henry II. That's what we mean here. Now, that meant something to a previous generation. It doesn't mean much to us. But it needs to, because Jesus is not looking for you to be his fan, to join his fan club. That's not on his agenda, and that's not what he's trying to do. So he wants total, complete loyalty. And here's another thing he wants. He wants to act as if he was a king, and he wants to be able to give, to be entitled to give orders and commands. Now, what about those words, orders and commands? Who likes those words? That doesn't sound very democratic, doesn't it? Surely what Jesus should do is float an idea, take soundings, get a bit of opinion poll surveys done, find out whether we agree, and then what he should do is sort of work with us to reach, to find common ground where we can sort of agree on a common agenda with him. Isn't that what he should do? If he was a politician, that's what he'd be doing. He wouldn't want to just lead from the front. He'd be wanting to go bring the people with him, you know, that kind of thing. And those ideas have seeped into our minds, and we think Jesus should act like some politician, where he should approach focus groups to find out what we are willing to go along with and so on. That's not the way he works. He gives orders and commands. He does not consult with us. He just gives orders and commands. And again, that's totally alien to our generation, to our thinking, to everything that we stand for and everything we think. But that's how we need to think. I follow a man who is a king way above Henry II. And those were the days when kings had total autocratic, absolute sovereignty. They could decide whether you lived or died on his own word alone, nothing else. But we are working for someone who's far more sovereign than that. Even Henry II had some limits on his power. But we work for someone far more sovereign. And we've got to change the way we think. So Jesus isn't giving suggestions or advice. He's giving commands, and our duty is to follow and obey what he says. These are direct orders. And again, unless you've been in the military, you don't really understand words like orders. What do you mean orders? Even how many people would get offended if their boss at work sent out a memo giving orders? I'm ordering you to go now, take this van, drive it to such and such. Here are my commands for you today. You'd be straight over to HR complaining about workplace bullying, wouldn't you? And about how your boss isn't showing you proper respect. Do you see? Because we don't think in these terms, but we need to change the way in which we think. So, the Christian life, being a disciple, is not about going to a holiday camp. When we were kids, we used to go to the Derbyshire Miners holiday camp. And so it's all gone, it's totally gone now. People don't go to holiday camps anymore. But there's the concept. Well, the Christian life isn't a holiday camp. A closer analogy would be to liken it to joining the army. And when you join the army, especially in wartime, you totally give up all freedom and all independence and all rights, including the right to be alive. They have the right in the army just to tell you to fight to the death. Sometimes they give orders, fight to the last man, no retreat. So when we retreated out of Dunkirk, everyone hears about the ones who got out. So about 350,000 got out at Dunkirk. But we actually lost about 50,000 that stayed behind. And they were told, no evacuation for you. You stay. And you hold the beaches until these men get off. You're not coming out. Now, what would you feel if you were part of that group that was told to stay there and fight to the end? There must be no giving in. There must be no retreat for them. They fight to defend the beaches. You're not coming home. There were only two options left for them. They were either going to get killed or taken prisoner. There was no hope of going out. Now, the point was, you might say, that's totally outrageous. For the military to give orders to this group to evacuate, but to this group to stay and fight to the end, that's not fair. But fairness doesn't enter into it, because you're dealing here with the right to give orders, including orders to fight to the death, which sometimes they give. And so, let me just try and finish with this last point. The thing is, you might say, well, all this talk about fighting to the death, you're just using melodramatic language. That's nothing to do with Christianity today. The worst that can happen to us is someone will be cross with us if we say some word that you're not supposed to say. Well, that may be true just at the minute, but what's increasingly going to happen, and is already happening in the underdeveloped world, especially where Islam is in the majority, is that being a Christian, and especially being a real one, is likely to involve the loss of your life. And this is the point. More Christians have been martyred in the 20th century than in all previous 19 centuries put together. So when we think of martyrdom, we think of, you know, these people in togas and stuff being martyred and being thrown to lions at the Colosseum and so forth. Well, actually, the amount, in absolute terms, of martyrdom in the first century was tiny compared to the 20th century, and even less compared to the 21st century. Thousands of people are being martyred every year, all over the world. But the media doesn't talk about it because it's not what they want to talk about, but it's what's happening. And it's principally happening at the hands of the religion of peace. And the great religion of peace is the one that's doing most of it. Not all of it, but most of it. So when it comes to killing Christians, that's what they specialise in, and that's what they're doing on an industrial scale. And so Islam has become, by far, now, the main persecutor of the church. It used to be Catholicism was the persecutor of the real Christians, but now it's Islam. And it's not only in the underdeveloped world, it's coming here. And so you're noticing, you should be noticing, that Islam is growing phenomenally in numbers and in intensity and in devotion to the jihad. All of this is growing exponentially. And it's no coincidence that just at the moment as we're speaking, there are people flooding into Europe in thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, soon to be millions, coming into Europe from places. A few of them are from places like Syria and are actual refugees. A few. The vast majority are young men coming here either as economic migrants or as jihadists. And even if they're not jihadists, their children will be, or are likely to be. And even if they're not jihadists, they are hostile to the West. And even if they were not jihadists, their interests are going to be taken increasingly into account in terms of making it necessary to curtail our freedoms of speech and of every other freedom to accommodate them. And that's already been happening, and it's going to happen vastly more. So if you look at the United Kingdom, we have far fewer Muslims than France. But France has got nearly 6 million Muslims, and that's rising rapidly. And because of their enormous birth rates, they are doubling every decade. Alright, well, what's going to be the position in 10 years' time? France will have 12 million Muslims. But what if the floodgates open and more come in by way of migration? These notional supposed refugees. then not only the natural birth rates within France and the United Kingdom and so on, but also those who are coming in. And what about those who come in? Guess where they're going to want to live?
Yes.
In the United Kingdom. Because if they have a choice under the freedom of movement within the European Union, how many of them are going to want to stay in Croatia and Greece and places like that? They're going to want to come to Germany, the UK and France, where high benefits are to be obtained. And that's where they're heading. So the point is, you've got to think, this is why I say, be willing to give up your life, because it's entirely relevant to you. 10, 20 years from now, Islam will be enormous within the United Kingdom and within Europe generally. And its power, its influence, and its numbers will be vastly higher than it is now. It's already a serious problem. It's going to be a life or death situation for many, many people. But the time to make your decisions about what you can do, what you're willing to face, is not then, it's now. Make your decision now that you're willing to be martyred. And anything less than that is a bonus. Okay, I'll stop there for that talk.